Welcome to the Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast. Conversations with leaders who made difficult decisions and built lasting legacies. I am Rick Williams. I speak and write about how leaders can be more successful. My best-selling book, Create the Future, is your essential guidebook for making difficult decisions. This podcast is an opportunity for me and for you to hear how leaders with a wide variety of backgrounds have managed the challenges they faced, made difficult decisions, and had courage when going forward is tough. You will learn important lessons from other leaders. You will find that engaging with our 30-minute conversation will be a great investment of your valuable time. So let's get started. Welcome to Create the Future podcast. I'm Rick Williams. The Create the Future podcast is a forum for leaders to share their stories about making difficult decisions for their company or any organization, and in some cases for themselves. My goal is to share these stories about leadership and decision-making with the broader leadership community so you will become a more successful leader of your organization. So we have a great guest today with a compelling story to tell, and you'll hear about lessons learned, what worked, what didn't work, and what the experience was like for him going through the important decisions that he made. So I'm excited to introduce you to John Walsh. John is the CEO of Endura Corporation. So John, welcome to the Create the Future podcast. Get us started by telling us a little bit about yourself, introduce yourself, and tell us about your story getting to this point in your career.
Sure. Thanks for having me, Rick. So John Walsh, founder and CEO of Endura. Endura is a specialty automaker specializing in specialty buses for the government. And I started the company almost 8 years ago now. I was 25 years old. I was working in private equity, and I was on automotive restructure teams. And I was assigned an electric bus company and got to learn the ins and outs of the government procurement sector, the transit sector, and EV. And I saw an opportunity to build a product. And when I first started, I didn't want to manufacture anything. That seemed really hard. But I saw that there wasn't one person that built an electric bus in, I think, the airport shuttle sector. And so I took a consultative approach. And, you know, I tell entrepreneurs that the best thing you can do is to get the contracts first and build the company second, because everything becomes a good problem to have. And, you know, one of the biggest failures that you see in early stage companies is a lack of product market fit and a lack of customer development. And when you take a consultative approach and when you look at what would people buy, and if you can look at validating whether or not people will buy, then everything becomes a good problem to have after that. And so when I first catalyzed the company, I went to our pilot client and I said, I'm not going to tell you what you need. You tell me what you need. Let's build this together. And it was the best customer development I ever got. And that would ended up being the single largest EV shuttle deployment by an airport in US history at the time. And admittedly, I didn't even have a bus, but I knew what to build. And that's really what got me started.
So say again, how old were you when you first did this?
I was 25.
Would it be okay if I said you were too young to realize how foolish what you were doing was?
100%. 100%. Yeah, the concept of how hard could it be is really interesting, because the answer is really hard. But I thought it was not going to be nearly as hard as it was.
Yeah, so I think, first of all, this is a wonderful example of the incredible value of younger people being entrepreneurs who don't realize all the things that could go wrong and say, okay, I think I can do this. Why not? Let's go. And then having to discover along the way all the things that, you know, really can get screwed up, and why, you know, most entrepreneurial companies don't succeed in the long run. But you've made it succeed. So talk a little bit about, you know, why did you do it? I mean, what in your mind were you thinking? And, you know, how did you think about the risk for yourself, the company, your investors? I mean, why did you end up doing this? How did you make that decision?
Well, you know, I always had an a desire to be an entrepreneur. And I first went into private equity because it fed my ADD, if you will. I was able to experience a lot of different companies and different things. And in all honesty, I wouldn't have started the company if I didn't feel undervalued by the company that I had worked for. I was filled with confidence but ignorance at the same time. I was assigned to this electric bus company, was put onto their payroll, and then I had gotten an option package, and I felt that they sort of went against their word right before my vesting schedule. The cliff had hit, and I said, let me see if I can try to do this myself. And a company is nothing more than a group of people getting together to solve problems. And a lot of times people forget that, and then they get caught too early into politics. But I think putting one foot in front of the other and seeing the path unfold as you start walking is really there's a significance to that, because it's impossible to plan the series of events that were to unfold. And I at first just saw, hey, I had an opportunity to fill an order, and I was gonna make some bucks and then see what happened next. And what that led me to do was to say, okay, I need to build the bus myself. And then because of that, I raised financing to buy a factory and then hire a bunch of Tesla engineers and then vertically integrate our own technology. And because of that, I really went through a lot of pain and suffering, because I bought an old school auto company and really not knowing much about it. But as long as you know what you don't know, not knowing what you don't know is the scary one. But knowing what you don't know and being focused and not giving up, it's amazing what you can accomplish, even at a young age. And the thing is that your asymmetric risk profile is so much more favorable to you when you're 25 than when you're 40. Because you don't have a mortgage, you don't have kids. Not some do, but most don't. At least nowadays. And so you're still living with your roommates eating Top Ramen. So how much lower could you go, right? So if you fail, then you're still back at square one, right? So I see a huge value in young people starting a business at a young age. And even if they fail, it's fine, because you're going to learn so much from that failure, right? And what I didn't tell you is that this is the third company I started, right? The first two I started and I learned a lot, but I ultimately failed. Right. I started a company when I was 18, started a company when I was 21. Right. But you have such a favorable risk profile when you're young to start a business.
So this is very interesting. You've actually started two companies before this one,
Yeah.
and both of them failed. Is that what you said?
Yeah. I would say from the technical standpoint, they would be failures.
Did you go back and say, okay, what did I learn from this? Or how did you take the fact that you had invested a huge chunk of your life in starting these two companies and they didn't work out?
Yeah, the big thing, Rick, was that when I was younger, I took my ideas as this incontrovertible truth. And I didn't have before validating it. And I looked at things from the bottom up, right? It's like, oh, I'm going to come up with an idea irrespective of market trends or tailwinds, market size, feasibility, barriers to entry. And I just said, that's a good idea. I'm going to run with it. And then I started. And I didn't know where to go, right? I didn't know how to put together a team. And they were in, I would say, the more hard science. One was a bio energy company, and the other was a geothermal company. And I didn't know much about that, but I just felt that it was an incontrovertible truth that I would succeed. And I ultimately failed. And the ego death that you have to go through that when you're a young adolescent makes you learn and makes you think of things differently. And so when I started Endera, I almost took myself as a constant critic of my own idea. And I was more looking at it from a scientific way, right? Like setting up an experiment, like, okay, I'll go and see if someone would buy buses based on these specs, based on finding different vendors that I could cobble together. And if I wrote on a spec sheet what they wanted, and if they signed it and then gave me an order, then I knew this thing had life. Before that, I was a skeptic, and so I didn't spend money on, I mean, I didn't really have any money, but I didn't spend money on things at making an assumption that I was going to succeed. But I just kept marching forward.
Yeah. Now, okay. So, just as background, because I don't want anybody to think about there's something true about you that isn't true. So, you're not somebody who has $100 million sitting in a bank account, and you're off playing at starting companies. Is that
No, I started Endera on my credit card.
right? Okay. So you're the more typical one that. No, you don't have $100 million in the bank. You have your credit
No.
card
Yep.
and a lot of energy. That's what you had. So,
That's it.
did you also have a cadre of two or three people who were your team that you were the three or four of you were going to find a project to do together, or was this mostly your own initiative?
I had really early people along the way that provided a tremendous amount of value. A couple in particular that became really great partners early on. I had people through the previous companies that I tried to start that ended up joining Endera later on after we started to get a little bit of momentum. But I definitely had one specific individual early on that was a great asset, particularly in the transit sector that I really knew nothing about. He started as a consultant and then became a partner. And then there were just people that I trusted that I built a great degree of loyalty with that came in and still work at Endera today. But it's really putting together a team and making them believe in the vision and then making them part of the success of it. I mean, equity is a very powerful thing.
So if I'm listening to you, what I think I'm hearing is that you are somebody who believed in yourself, that you believed that you had that unique combination of as somebody who could create a vision of what could be commercially successful, what was required to make it commercially successful, and then go find the people to bring into it to create the company and the suppliers and all that sort of stuff. I'm putting that in contrast with a person who says, I'm the world's greatest expert in this particular technology. I'm going to start a company around this technology. Am I characterizing who you are correctly?
I'm not an engineer at all. I'd say I'd be more of a finance person by trade, but understanding business and understanding product market fit and understanding trends and opportunities, and then being able to see a vision and then bring people together and unify them towards that common vision, and then bring people in that are smarter than you in those specific fields that are necessary as a component to make your vision successful. And orchestrating, coordinating, and leading that effort is where my expertise sits, versus being a product engineer. I would say from a high level, I've architected the product because I've been able to define requirements, customer requirements, to make the product successful or unique value proposition points. But really, I could honestly say that looking at a value proposition, validating that with the customer early on, and then having the path unfold that you need to go on to get there is the right set of ingredients. I had a couple of influential advisors early on that taught me one thing was called the business model canvas, and the lean model. Those are really two great tools to when you first start up a company to help guide you through the. Because when you're an entrepreneur, especially at an early stage, you get bombarded with opportunities, right? So it's like, you're going on this path and then you're like, okay, which way should I go? And then you try to decipher good data from bad data. And then you couple that with taking steps forward and then doors opening. And then you, which a lot, I would say a lot of entrepreneurs have ADD, but they all of a sudden get a shiny opportunity, and then scope creep kicks in, right? And then they lose track of their main mission, right? And so focus is so important in that effort. But I would say that the lean model and the business model canvas are great tools to help guide you through all that complexity.
Yeah, I mean, I frankly, one of the things that I think people who come to entrepreneurship having one unique skill is that they're so reliant on being the expert in whatever that component is. And it could be technology or it could be finance or it could be marketing. I don't care what it is. Any unique
Yeah.
channel or that they personally come to the enterprise with, that is asking for a lot of trouble because young companies don't succeed by being, just good at one channel, one element of the whole enterprise. So you have to have a leader who is going to say, okay, I'm going to get the best engineering, the best science, the best marketing, the best customer relations, the right financing that'll fit for this particular. And you have to be able to bring all of that together in, a not. And not pretend to be the expert. I mean, that's what you're doing,
Yeah.
which is, I think, why you've been uniquely successful in a really very challenging. I mean, I want to hear a little bit more about why the company has been successful. I don't mean just why it's been successful, but what it's gone through in the last couple of years. I'd actually like to just, for the benefit of the people listening to this, draw a distinction between you, the decision maker, very early when you were starting the company, and you as a decision maker now that you have a corporate enterprise that you're running.
Yeah.
When you were, so I was asking you whether A, money wasn't an object, so you didn't care if you lost money, like, so what? And you said no. It was you had your credit card. And you also said, as I'm interpreting what you said, is that no, there wasn't a core of three or four people who were trying to one venture and another venture another until they made it work. You were pretty much sort of bringing the right people in with each venture, and it was pretty much you as the key decision maker. Am I correct in that?
Yeah, early on, but we had a founding team, right? And like I would say, we
Yeah.
have a founding team, and we have people that have been with us through the beginning that I could have not done this without. And I would say today, delegating decisions downward is such a key function of being able to scale. We're the fastest growing specialty bus company in the country right now. And when we first bought the factory in Ohio, they did 40 buses a year. They did about three a month. And fast forward to now, we're doing three a day, and we're tracking to do 700 this year. And so there's been a huge scale. And a key thing is having level five autonomous managers underneath you that are really great in what they do, that you trust undeniably, that know how you think, that channel you in a lot of decisions, that understand the key vision and the key strategic plan that we're putting forth. And you trust them to make these strategic decisions because you brought them in because they have a better level of competency and their expertise than you do. And so having that core team, building that team, investing in that team is such a key ingredient to scaling. Because when I was first starting the company, I was doing everything, and I had my hands in everything from writing documents and presentations and to phone calls, to meetings, to Excel models. But you have to learn to let go and really rely on the team around you to make key decisions. But it's giving the clarity in where we're heading that's important, and then making good decisions.
So I'm making a little bit of presumption here. I don't know. Are you when you were at the very start of this, when it was pretty much you as a decision maker, did you have a wife or a professor or a clergyman or somebody who was or your best buddy friend who was the one you would take off and say, "Gee, I'm thinking about this. What do you think?" Or how did you? I'm really just. I want to make a contrast between you, the decision
Yeah.
maker then, and you, the decision maker now. What was that? Who were you and looking advice for or counsel, or maybe you didn't. I mean, what was going on at that very early stage for you?
Well, when it was early before we had investors, it was somewhat of a wild, wild west, right? I mean, we didn't have a factory, and it was really just trying to chase an order opportunity and then wheeling and dealing. And then I had an early partner that I brought in that, it had taken an operational role and, was originally a consultant. And then when you get investors, then there's more structure that needs to be had because you have a larger fiduciary duty now, and you have people's money on the line. And I had my father's tax advisor was the first person I went to trying to structure something, just because we had started getting contract opportunities, and he saw the opportunity, he saw what we were doing, and he got excited, and then he wrote me my first check that seeded our first round that we raised a little over $20 million to catalyze the company. And his family office was a quarter of that. And so, I really looked at him early on helping with the financial engineering necessary to structure an investment. And then I had key advisors in specific areas. I personally didn't have one mentor that was, I went to everything with. And whether it's the complex nature of the fact that we're doing automotive manufacturing, or just the fact that you have to look at advisors in a lot of times where they've got an expertise in their specific area, right? And so you've got to put all these different pieces of advice through your judgment filter and then make a decision based on where their experience sits, right? Like, I mean, there's a lot of people who will give advice, but they've never actually physically been in the position that you're in, right? And then there's people who will give advice that have been, right? So, but no one's, I think, gonna be 100% in the situation you're in all different instances, right? Like, I have a great advisor that's a president of a large PE firm that's fantastic when it comes to the finance world and the M&A world, and just me navigating through all of that. It particularly related to just our financing transactions that we've done. But I wouldn't go to other members of our advisory group for that. So I think having a group of advisors that can help you in specific areas is so helpful.
Okay, so let's go to the company, to you as the leader of a complex company in a very complicated world. So you are making electric buses in which there's a very complicated regulatory environment that in many ways either puts you in business or puts you out of business. You're dealing with a board of directors. You have a whole set of outside investors, both private investors and institutional investors. You have a leadership team that's helping you run the company. I'm just building a picture of complexity here for you. Okay, so when you have a major decision that you're going to make and could be a new financing round or acquiring a company or divesting or opening a new plant or anything like that, how do you make that decision? How does your board play into it? How does your leadership team play in it? How do you bring in outside advisors that are, not part of the corporate staff? Talk about how do you make decisions now when you're the leader of in this such very complicated leadership world?
Sure. Well, I've typically looked at the problems. I spend most of my time on the most important thing for me to focus on. And that's kind of how I guide my time. In terms of getting an idea or looking at the white space, I've typically tried to focus my energy on identifying that white space or identifying where we need to go. And then I look at the opportunity, and I make my initial assessment, and then I evaluate that opportunity in my own judgment based on my peers and my people who I trust, and I have them weigh in on the opportunity. right? And like, 4 years ago when we bought Metro Titan Group in the Ottawa plant, I looked at the opportunity, and we had a specific partner that was going to join the group as a result of it. And we saw the problem, which was that you can build a bus from one person, and then we saw an opportunity to solve that, and then bring things together. And in terms of financing, I typically lead the financing efforts. That's my role and responsibility. But there's a lot of moving parts in a bus. I mean, there really is, and it's no pun intended. And just dealing with the regulatory dynamic, dealing with the capital markets. I mean, one of the things that has just been crazy is over the last 5 years, the capital markets and what happened under the Biden administration and the EV SPAC boom and then the bust and then inflation going through the roof and then the capital markets getting squeezed and then needing to raise continued financing to bridge us through. And bringing in great financial partners is a super key ingredient. But again, you need to lean on them, and you can't have self-confirmation bias in anything that you do. And it's you need to make sure that you run things through a great group of people.
Talk a little bit about, and I, as you know, I write a lot about your board of directors and how your board of directors can be a more a value, an important value accelerator for the company. How do you, and there's no right or wrong answer to this. I'm just trying to understand what you're actually doing. Do you, how do you involve your board when in very key decisions have to be made? And yes, the board has to make decisions. I don't mean you're hiding anything from the board, but how does the board specifically play into, and then how do you relate with the board when important decisions have to be made?
Well, a lot of times, even though there might not be a governance obligation for me to run things by the board, I do because I trust their opinion,
Yep.
right? So, I want their weigh in, I want their buy-in, and I want their support. And a lot of times it could be key things that maybe I'm on the fence about, right? From a governance perspective, I would say that I would be over the top on what I involve the board in. Then less because I trust their input and I want their input more than making decisions in a vacuum because I'm super paranoid about making sure I don't make decisions in a vacuum and that I've fully vetted them. So I would say that getting a good board is super important because you're going to want to go to them for things, right? More than less.
Yeah, and so let me just take another angle. At another angle, I'm assuming that there is a core leadership team of key leaders within the corporation.
Yes.
Do you meet with them on a regular basis? Say, hey guys, we're going to meet as a leadership team and talk about the decisions that are coming up or where we're going, or how do you work with that core leadership team?
Well, we have weekly meetings more on an operational basis for specific resources or support that they need. There's a lot of ad hoc phone calls and conversations as well. And then we have strategic planning meetings that are more strategy versus tactical. And so making sure that you have strategic meetings and you delineate between the two so that there's a focused effort on strategy versus operations and tactical are key differentiators. Sometimes people mix them together and then meetings go awry and then they become unproductive. I'm a big fan of not having too many meetings and a big fan of not having too large of a meeting where people don't have engagement, because we have a rule at the company is if you're not getting value out of the meeting, then you can go and leave the meeting and do whatever you want that's contributing towards creating value for the company, right? Or whatever you think is going to create value. Just because sometimes you get meetings that are historical that add up, and you have these legacy meetings that are on calendars, and then all of a sudden you look at this, you're just like, I'm spending too much of my time in meetings, it's unproductive. But I would say delineating between strategy and tactical is super important in making sure you have both the operational execution risk and effectiveness managed, but then you also have strategic input brought to the management team on where the company's headed from a strategy perspective. And then goal setting broad-based, right? Making sure that there's clear goals that everybody can recite and say, that everybody can map all of their departmental goals to and KPIs to and push downwards is important, right? Because when you have 10 people in a company, it's really easy to coordinate, right? But when you've got over 100 people, 100, 150 people, or 200 people, it becomes really hard. So that's where these structures become even more important.
What do you do to make sure there's somebody in your life who says, John, I don't really think you're on the right path here, or I think you'd be smart to look at this in a different way? What do you do to get that as part of what's going on around you?
John, on a personal level or on a business level?
Well, we can come to that personal level separately, but talk about it as far as part of making the company successful.
Here's a big thing that's important to me and that I think is important in having a successful company that can scale quickly is you have to have a culture in place where everybody can be brutally honest with each other and respectful as well. But, brutally honest. And I try to make as concerted of an effort to foster having the team tell me how they really feel. Tell me when they think I'm being stupid. Tell me when they think I'm being wrong and tell me why. Because what that does is it brings out the truth and it brings out a culture of best ideas win approach. It also brings out a culture of no egos and all of those barriers being broken down. Can allow you to be agile, pivot, make good decisions quicker, and mitigate risk of failure and maximize risk of success. So making sure that culturally, because you get a lot of ego sometimes, right, with groups of people, and it starts from the top, right? And so being able to quote unquote beat each other up and then not take anything personally and then have an effective result at the end of the day, it makes you more effective as a team.
Well, no, that's it's re it is so important. And people who won't accept having someone around them who says, "Hey, wait a second, you might not be right on this. Have you thought about this?" And is extremely important to successful leadership. Well, before we wrap up here, I want to take advantage of you as an expert in the business you're in. So you're not in the electric car business, but you are in the electric bus business, the electric vehicle business. I was with somebody last week who is a big time investor in electric technology. I will just say that broadly, worldwide, who basically says the Chinese are so far ahead in electric cars that outside the US, they're going to just take over the whole market. Where's your view on where all of the electrification of vehicles is going, if you have a view, and kind of how should
Yeah.
we understand it?
That's a great question. And just to clarify, one of the biggest differentiators that we did as a company is we bought this legacy business. And so what we saw early on was that EV was going to be a transition and that building legacy bus bodies as part of our core business to generate the economies of scale, generate labor, overhead efficiencies, purchasing power efficiencies to then marry whether it was a gas chassis or an electric chassis to the same body manufacturing process allowed us to create a profitable business model where a lot of EV makers, particularly in the United States that had sprouted up 5, 6 years ago, were not profitable. We decided to take a different approach and leverage a profitable legacy business via an acquisition. To then vertically integrate an EV manufacturing process. Now, what's different with our sector is that we sell to the government. And you have to have at least 70% of your vehicle be Buy America compliant and have a Buy America supply chain. And so the Chinese automakers have never been able to play in this sector because we're selling to the government. And so there's really no one in this market aside from us that's delivering electric shuttles to the transit sector. And we also have an electric school bus product as well. And so there's minimal entrants in this market, and I would say even less than there were a few years ago, because we were able to have a profitable business model. But we're operating in this insulated niche that is perfect for electrification, but the Chinese market, the Chinese automakers aren't able to tap into it. Now, what I will say is that in a lot of other market sectors, the Chinese are way ahead. And if you're talking about the passenger car sector and in markets outside of the US, they're having a huge amount of market penetration, undoubtedly. And so they are a huge player. I mean, and they built their supply base a decade before we even started thinking about it. And so, they're completely vertically integrated all the way down to the raw input materials from a battery perspective. So, definitely internationally, they're going to be a huge player. In the US, I think that there's a lot of protectionist policies. Now, I think there's also in the Western world increasing amounts of protectionist policies that are coming out of Europe and other countries, because there's a lot of manipulation going on that's distorting pricing of these EVs and flooding markets and really hurting domestic auto producers. So it's going to be very interesting to see how the next 10 years plays out.
Well, John, I want to thank you. This has been an incredibly valuable contribution, and your stories I know will be very valuable to people listening, whether they're a 25-year-old entrepreneur or somebody who's running a at-scale company, because you've done it all, and I give you an enormous amount of credit. So if someone in the audience wants to learn more about you and Endira, how can they do that?
Well, you can look at our website at www.enduramotors.com, and happy to have a conversation with anybody who'd like to learn more about our product. You can also reach out to us on LinkedIn via our Endura company page.
John, let me just say, as kind of a little bit of, I don't know if I'm going to say as an endorsement, but I am somebody who knows a little bit about the company and you and the history. I would absolutely encourage anybody to learn more about what Endura is doing and where it's going. It's a really an incredible company with a great future ahead. So I want to thank our audience for taking the time to listen to John's story. It's quite a remarkable one, and learn from his experience as both an entrepreneur and now the leader of a company in significant growth stage. So if
Thank
you
you,
have a
Rick.
compelling story to tell about making difficult decisions that you'd like to share, please contact me and come on to my podcast as a guest. So if you want to do that, go to Rick WilliamsLeadership.com, and then go to the Create the Future podcast section of my website. Again, that's RickWilliamsLeadership.com. So remember that you create the future by the decisions you make today. So take the time when you have an important decision to get it right, and yes, have a little bit of fun along the way. Until next time, be well. What an interesting and inspiring conversation. I hope you found it as valuable as I did. Thank you for listening. Let me know if you have a compelling story to tell about making tough choices for your organization or for yourself. Coming on my podcast is a way to share what you have learned with a wider audience. If someone you know would be a great guest, please make an introduction. I welcome leaders with a story to tell and important learning to share. You can contact me about the podcast at podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. That's podcast.rickwilliamsleadership.com. Please share the link to my podcast with your colleagues. They will thank you for getting them access to these valuable conversations. And finally, please give us a great rating on and subscribe to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon Music. Just search for Create the Future with Rick Williams. Thank you for listening to Create the Future with Rick Williams podcast, conversations with leaders who make difficult decisions and build lasting legacies.